The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Good morning. Welcome to Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR-FM Pittsfield Community Radio. I'm Sean Sayre here with you this morning on Friday, May 23rd. Glad to have you on board. You're also listening to us on 88.1 WSBR in Lee and watching us on Pittsfield Community Television's website, perhaps PCTV Select, all kinds of different ways. Maybe get the podcast later on. Who knows how you listen to the show, but we appreciate it. And we do have an excellent show for you here this morning. We have two of the best journalists here in Berkshire County who are going to be talking about the state of journalism these days, both nationally, locally, all kinds of things we're going to be talking about. If you care about the Fourth Estate, if you care about good information, you're going to want to hear this show. I think we're going to be delving into some areas that are very, very important for all of us to know and not take for granted, knowing that we get good information on things that are going on. We're going to talk to Greg Sakenik from the Berkshire Eagle and Josh Landes from WAMC Northeast Public Radio. So that is the show for this Friday, and you're definitely going to want to stay here. First, let's go to the weather forecast and see what we have in store for us today.
WTBR radar weather for the Pittsfield area. Today, mostly cloudy. Patchy drizzle this morning, then showers likely this afternoon. Highs in the lower 50s. West wind around 5 miles per hour. Chance of rain 70%. Tonight, showers likely. Lows in the mid-40s. West wind 5 to 10 miles per hour. Chance of rain 60%. Saturday, mostly cloudy with a 50% chance of showers. Highs in the mid-50s. West wind 5 to 10 miles per hour with gusts up to 20 miles per hour. Weather forecasts for WTBR-FM are provided by the National Weather Service.
Yeah, we just can't seem to get our way out of that rain and that pattern that we're in. I've been hearing that Memorial Day is going to look a little better, a little warmer, but we'll see. Now I'm starting to hear that they're going to, you know, creep in some showers there too. So I just don't know. I don't know what to tell you there, but we are at the end of May and we were actually talking about snow. I thought I got snow out of the forecast and here it is. Somehow we're still talking about it. Anyway, Morning Drive on 89.7 WTBR-FM and welcome my guests now, Greg Sakenik and Josh Landes. Gentlemen, both, thank you for being here today.
Thanks, Sean, for having us.
Thank you for having us. It's an honor.
Absolutely. Well, so like I said, this is a show I've wanted to do for a while and wanted to get people in who are on the front lines of reporting on the news, the things that we only hear about sometimes because folks like you get out there and get the story and publish it, whether it's in print, in digital, or on broadcast. And so that's where we are today, is talking with these folks. So, Greg, I guess we'll start with you. Just give us a quick history background, how you got into journalism, how long you've been doing it, where you've been, what have you been doing?
Boy, that's reaching way back. That's going back to like Crosby Middle School.
Well, there you see, it does have to start.
The Crusader at St. Joseph. I've been reading the Berkshire Eagle since I could read. So that's how far back I go with that particular institution. just kind of found my way into student journalism at St. Joan at UMass. And I mean, I wanted to write every day and get paid for it, but I think deep down I wanted to sort of, there's a thing about the business where you're sort of in the middle of the action and sort of involved. Mm-hmm. And there's sort of a regular sort of rhythm and excitement to that. And a bit of an endorphin rush when you actually get a tiger by the tail, you know, and it's, you know, a bit like a virus and I couldn't get rid of it. You know, found my way through the news business, a little paper in New Hampshire, the Eagle, the Associated Press, ESPN.com, got laid off there and was like, okay, well, now what? And I was figuring I'd try to find something outside the news business, but it would not let go of me, even though it took, you know, some months to get, you know, to get another job, and wound up at the papers at the Eagle, previously owned in Vermont. Those were sold off again, and then Found my way back back to the Eagle, which at first I thought was going to be strange, but it's actually been wonderful.
Yeah.
So here I am.
Awesome. And I know we'll talk about some of those changes in the news business and the media landscape in general, too, I think, on this show, because that resume kind of speaks to that in a lot of ways. Josh, tell us about your journey to being the Berkshire Bureau Chief for WAMC.
Well, a lot of it was luck and happenstance. I never studied journalism, and I never did journalism really until essentially I got this job. Huh. So, but I think back like classic like Berkshire County memories. You know, when I was in high school, my first job, you know, I'm part of the Pittsfield's small Jewish community. It's tight knit. One of my first jobs was working for Richie Simons and Ben Cohen at their law firm. Richie mm-hmm. Simons, now a judge. Richie represented one of the young men who was a part of the drug sting in Great Barrington back in the aughts when David Capels was DA. Mm-hmm. And so my first job, you know, I call it clerking generously. I was filing stuff for Richie. He was extremely kind. And after school, after PHS, I would walk over to North Street and file stuff. But he let me sit in court during those proceedings at a young age. Mm-hmm. And it was absolutely fascinating to sort of see someone like articulate a really specific and pronounced challenge to power and authority. And this, you know, in Berkshire County, you know, the DA's office is one of the great institutions. It's a very powerful force in the county. And that whole case was such a dramatic and outspoken moment for people trying to negotiate a lot of the complicated politics of what Mr. Capels was trying to accomplish with these prosecutions of, you know, full extent of the law, school zone violations for these young people in Great Barrington. It was a fascinating community conversation. Mm-hmm. And I remember when Capels came to my AP Gov class at PHS, me and my friend, who were like the annoying guys in class, and I've continued that tradition of being an annoying guy in the Berkshires. But, you know, like, so Capels was right there, and we could, like, as teenagers, challenge him on, you know, you're the, you know, he's like, well, I'm following the law. And we're like, well, you're following this interpretation of the law. And, you know, it was the sort of the first time in my life where I realized that, like, you can, as Greg was talking about, it's not that hard to find yourself with a seat at the table in Berkshire County. Certainly, you know, I think we're luckier than a lot of people, but, you know, it was wild to be like, oh, wow, this powerful guy is sitting right here. He's done this thing that's generated this controversy and conversation. And this is like a real debate where this community is trying to form its values in real time in front of me.
Yeah.
And it's crazy that like decades later, I'm, you know, still irritating DAs and what have you. But like that hook that you get that Greg was talking about, where you're like, oh, this is a fascinating conversation. We're laying our cards on the table. And, you know, this is something we can all be a part of. That was really amazing. Mm-hmm. And that full journey back to doing that is kind of a long story, but suffice to say I was in the right place at the right time in Berkshire County. I studied radio production and ethnomusicology at Hampshire College, also in the Pioneer Valley. So yeah, I mean, honestly, it came down to I had listened to NPR in the backseat of my parents' Volvo for most of the 90s. I knew exactly what it was supposed to sound like. And, you know, it's about being able to stimulate that conversation and be able to be a public clearinghouse where this kind of, you know, working out who we are, what our values are, like that's the most fascinating part of this every day.
Yeah.
I love it.
It's a multifaceted job, it sounds like. And tell me, Greg, how you see your job. Is it a storyteller? Is it someone who's looking for the story beneath the veneer of the story?
It's a little of everything.
Yeah.
I mean, it's... you know, it's being sort of, you know, the sort of speaking truth to power. Mm-hmm. That Josh is talking about, but it's also sort of being witness to history as well. I mean, I was in the middle of the reporting the Archdiocese of Boston child sex abuse crisis, mm-hmm. you know, and it was there at news conferences in front of, you know, cardinals and lawyers for survivors. And, you know, just sort of I just kind of remember the sort of the power of that moment. Mm-hmm. I mean, so you're sort of bearing witness to some stuff. It's also a storyteller. It's a little bit detective.
Mm-hmm.
It's also first draft of history as well. And it's, you know, I think trying to sort of get beyond sort of the sort of obvious in the front and trying to explain why, mm-hmm. you know, that's, I mean, I did a lot of work when they were discovering PCB tainted fill in houses in Lakewood,
mm-hmm.
Back in the 1990s, back when I rode my dinosaur to work, that was, you know, there's nothing more personal and more valuable to a person than their home. And, you know, to find out that, you know, the free fill that they got was actually, you know, tainted with
It was free for a reason.
It was free for a reason that Fuller's Earth athlete was actually had soaked up, you know, transformer oil.
Yeah.
And just sort of being able to have a, you know, a seat at the table, I guess, as Josh mentioned, but also sort of be kind of a witness of these sort of powerful moments and try to explain, you know, who people are and why this matters. I think, you know, that's the challenge is, you know, it could be facts and figures, and it could be very superficial, but, you know, it's trying to sort of dig beyond that and to get into how this affects people.
When you have a big story like that, do you know the real long impact of it? Do you think it might be just something that blows over, or do you know from that moment you say, this is going to be big, we're going to be talking about this for months or for years?
I think at the start of something, you're never quite sure. I think it will always surprise you. I mean, some things seem kind of obvious, but I'm just trying to remember. I mean, Watergate started, like, you know, the first story in the Watergate scandal was, like, tucked way back, you know, like, at the back of the front section of the Washington Post. You know, some things are kind of obvious. Yeah, this is going to be big. I mean, the crisis in Boston, for example, I mean, that started with a single story in the Arts and Entertainment Weekly in town. It was the Phoenix that actually ran the first story about the lawsuit that Patrick McSorley brought against John Gagin and the Archdiocese. I mean, that wasn't in the Globe or the Herald, and it picked up speed, and it picked up, you know, and people started to figure out, wait a minute, there's something here. And because people were, you know, in the past, in that particular story, people had sort of been intimidated about coming forward,
sure,
or figured, you know, that this will just go away.
Yeah, and there's echoes of that too now in stories that we're following right here in Berkshire County.
And it turns out that it won't go away, and that there's actually this has resonance, and people were harmed, and, you know, and there need to be changes.
Yeah,
and, you know, is this about people or is it about the institution? You know, so I always find that, you know, those stories fascinating. Yeah, sometimes you know, and sometimes it just turns into way more than you bargained for.
Josh, when you get a story like that, where you're suspecting something more is going on than what you're being fed from the official line, what kinds of things do you, first of all, do you sense that immediately? Is that something where you say, I think there's something more there? And then what are your next actions? What do you do after that?
Well, I mean, it's complicated. I mean, it's sort of like you never, the instinct to be defensive, to protect, to try to, you know, minimize or move on. Like, you can understand how, like, larger ships or institutions try to, like, brush off these things that they don't want to spend their time and resources on. And, you know, it's a complicated question. You know, a lot of the time, I think, to echo part of what Greg said, at the end of the day, I think we bring this, we talk a lot about, like, the encroaching role of AI in our culture. We talk about the consolidation of media, corporate ownership, etc. I really see this venue of journalism to be a way where you can really talk about people in a really direct way and, you know, carry those stories through. So, I mean, when it comes to, like, institutional malfeasance, there are times, yeah, where you meet someone who has a weirdly perfect story that encapsulates injustice or encapsulates marginalization, and that becomes, like, this way to crack open a larger story to say, like, through this person's trials and travail, we understand more about this larger system that is not working. And I love that. So, I mean, yeah, it's a complicated balance, because on one hand, you're running down all the facts and figures and you're researching and backing things up. On the other hand, like, there is, like, this rich humanistic narrative that you can explore and, you know, tie in these larger, look, there's always going to be corruption, there's always going to be lies, you know. Elected officials are not normal people, they're not, and I don't treat them that way, and I don't think people should. I think there's, like, sometimes
how are they not normal people? So go into that.
We had the new CEO of WAMC came to visit, and we went to, like, you know, meet all the local officials and went to North Adams and Pittsfield, and I was perversely a little excited that she picked up there was a little bit of tension in the room many of those times, because you know, if I go to North Adams or I go to Pittsfield, I've reported very critically on those institutions, and that's not, like, unknown to people. Like, you know, when I broke the story about the fire chief in North Adams hitting someone with a vehicle and hospitalizing her with a work vehicle on the clock, I call him up and he's in the office. He wasn't even taken off. By the end of the day, you know, after my inquest to, you know, Mayor Maxey, he had been put on leave for an investigation, but that hadn't happened. He had hit someone with a work vehicle on the job as the chief of the fire department, then went right back to the office. So, you know, there are the, and so I'm sitting in a room with this guy. But so there needs to to be this, like, there should be that tension. Like, I don't want to be your friend if you're an elected official. You are responsible for other people's lives. Mm-hmm. You make an impact on the world as someone who has chosen to enter the public sphere. That comes with immense responsibility. And, you know, my instinct is not to chum up to you. My instinct is to say, you're holding power in your hands. Mm-hmm. You've crossed this threshold. You're not the same as me anymore because people have put their trust and their hope in you, and you're leading this community now. So, you know, I think that there needs to be that tension, and then there needs to be that sense that someone's watching you.
So a reporter can walk in and be instantly persona non grata in a room like that.
Been there, done that.
Right? Possible?
Well, I think it's much worse if you walk into a room full of powerful people as a journalist and they say, oh, buddy, how are you? That you're not doing your job right.
Not, I mean, if you're doing the public any service that way.
It's not my job to be a cool friend to a local official. It's my job to say, we're watching you, and you have responsibility. And part of our job is to call balls and strikes, as my my boss would say.
Who was it that said that journalists don't have friends, they have sources? I don't know who said that, but it's a great quote. I've used it a lot.
Well, you live in a town where you know where a third of the populace is your cousin. It's like, okay, it's that's, you know, like, it's a little difficult sometimes. I think it's also it's a sense of all right, you know, these are people who have chosen a role that requires accountability and
public scrutiny.
Yeah, public scrutiny. And you knew that, you know, in the words of Super Chicken, you knew the job was dangerous when you took it. You know, so. Yeah, that's got to come along with the job. And yeah, I'm going to be fair to you, but I got to ask you these difficult questions because you're on the clock here and you're responsible. And when mistakes get made, and they do, I mean, someone has to step up and be accountable and not just sort of, you know, and try to fix things instead of sort of trying to protect the institution.
Yeah, there's a theme these days I'm hearing that. The idea that you might ask a difficult question, and I'm thinking more nationally than locally right now, but maybe it applies locally too, is just wrong, right? Is that why would you ask that question?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can't tell you how often I interview Democrats who sort of suspect that as like a public radio station, we're like immediately simpatico or whatever. I mean, I asked Liz Warren about what it was like to be a millionaire. You know what I mean? She didn't like that. We had an interview the day Bernie Sanders' memoir came out. I was like, hey, great to have you on the phone. Bernie Sanders has blamed you for the failure of progressivism in the 2016 primary. It was hysterical. She didn't like that. But that's the point. I don't want to get on the phone with these people because it's so cool to talk to a senator. It's not. They're just some guy. They're probably wealthier than you are, but they're just some guy. So, you know, there needs to be that tension at all times. You know, even in this polarizing environment, even with a Republican, you know, administration that's actively trying to destroy public media, you know, I still want Democrats to sweat as much as Republicans. That's super important to the job. So, you know, you got to live on that edge.
Well, and it's interesting, too, in a state like Massachusetts, which is certainly a deep blue state, as you mentioned, dominated by Democratic politicians. Throughout the state, there's some pockets of Republican, but for the most part, Democrats have free reign. So in the state house, is the press pushing back enough on that here? Or, you know, flip the book a bit and think about the reddest state you could think of. Are the journalists in those states going after the powerful and the elected and the people making decisions? Is that actively happening enough today?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, there's so many amazing journalists all over the country doing amazing work, pushing back on the power structures where they live. I think in Massachusetts, and you know, I'm fascinated to hear what Greg's reaction is like. You know, it's complicated. It is to some degree, not to borrow too much rhetoric from the campaign trail. There is a sense of single party rule in Massachusetts, and when it comes to how unbelievably untransparent our legislature is, like right now, I mean, I can't talk to the state auditor enough because Anna DeSoglio is like a Democrat waging war with the other Democrats. Which, you know, as a journalist, I'm like, this is absolutely fascinating. We have this party that in many ways is monolithic, but all of a sudden
unusual.
There's a huge rupture that's not going away anytime soon.
No, that's not new news either. I mean, I go back all the way to Michael Dukakis and Ed King, you know, back when the Democratic Party sort of contained this, you know, it was less monolithic, or at least on the surface, at least. I think there's always tension underneath. I think about, you know, just because the example that comes to mind is the Texas Tribune. You know, sort of, you know, you have a state, you know, with a powerful Republican governor and sort of everyone sort of in lockstep and everyone's just sort of trying to out conservative each other. And here's this institution because in a state like Texas, you have large, you know, areas, you know, metropolitan areas that are more Democratic, like Austin, like Dallas, like Houston. And And so, you know, I haven't been there, don't have friends there, but I can only imagine that that gets uncomfortable, and that you're a bit of a target. Mm-hmm. That maybe people don't return your call as quick as they would like before, because you know, do some talking. Because there is kind of a sense of go along and get along, but they're there in that role of speaking truth to power. And I think even in a state that sort of seems to have this sort of political monoculture, I mean, there's always been sort of a dichotomy, you know, between, you know, maybe progressive and very progressive, mm-hmm. or progressive mm-hmm. and more sort of, I mean, sort of would have been Republicans 50 years ago, until that became sort of untenable.
Yeah.
So I believe
Blue Dog is the
Blue Dog, or folks who moved to New Hampshire. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I like what you're hitting on here, Greg. Though.
But there is that, you know, and people maybe don't want to get into that. Maybe they want to sort of keep that quiet.
Well, then also, you know, when you have a party like in Massachusetts with the Democrats, you know, often we are like as a Commonwealth, we are like legendarily undemocratic in our primaries. We have, especially in Berkshire County. I mean, my God, we're sitting in like there are often there's so much comfort in the Democratic Party here. There aren't these primaries; these conversations don't happen, and that's where me and Greg have to rise to the fore. Where if no one's going to challenge you for office for decades in a substantial way, it's our responsibility to make sure that these hard conversations are happening. Mm-hmm. You know, I know that. If you talk to some politicians, I'm a gotcha journalist, and it's kind of, I can live with that because like, yeah, I'm going to ask you tough questions. And like, if you've entered the sphere and are uncomfortable doing that, like, you know, let's say that there was an actual, some sort of, you know, parity between parties in Massachusetts, there should be some other opposition party making you have those conversations. And for want of that, for lack of that, that's where we really have to show up for these people.
Well, those difficult questions often lead to the best answers. Actually, people say, well, why did you ask that? But, you know, I mean, I can recall a couple instances where I kind of made someone mad and they actually, you know, gave me three or four stories right off the bat because they just suddenly just kind of got a bee under their bonnet. I was like, you know, how dare you turned into, well, let me tell you another thing. You know, and so, yeah,
well, there's that veneer.
It works.
And you have to get underneath
chip away
it.
At it.
Yeah, that's our job. Like, yeah. I hate press conferences. I hate hearing like we're all doing great and we've all done a great job. Like,
well, because a press conference itself is staged to deliver a certain message in a certain way, right?
Yeah,
and to deliver a success. No one gives a press conference because there's something terrible happen unless they have to, right?
Yeah. Well, it's fascinating. You know, I thought like over the course of like Linda Tyer's time in office, I thought it was fascinating running Pittsfield as mayor. You know, I sort of felt like she became a bit glossier and more of a politician over that time. So it's very funny to go back to Pete Marchetti now, who's a really still a salt of the earth guy in an interview in almost any circumstance, which is weirdly refreshing because that veneer gets, it's exhausting to get like a national level politician on the phone and hear regurgitated, you know, rhetoric.
Ed Riley and Jerry Doyle were more like that too.
Yeah.
You know, certainly Jerry.
In what way?
In that they were, you could just kind of, there wasn't the sort of that glossy veneer.
No.
You know, professional politics hadn't really come to Pittsfield yet.
Or you didn't sense the guardedness of it?
Like, yeah.
If you're getting the question, well, what are you asking
me
that
question
for? I mean,
at that point, we're only, you know, 5-10 years removed from when you could just kind of walk into the corner office and say, hey, what's going on? Or when the city council was very much a full contact sport, complete with fistfights. Those were the days.
Well, and there was an effort in Pittsfield under a former mayor to lock down all information, if you remember correctly. It was about 10 or 15 years ago, where no city department head could say anything to a reporter without it first going through the mayor's office. And that actually has some echoes of what's going on at the top in the federal government right now as well, seems like. I don't know if you remember that time.
Well, I don't remember. I think I wasn't here for that time, but I can tell you that, you know, this kind of a legend that the late Glenn Drohan managed to cover North Adams during the months long periods where he had annoyed John Barrett the Third to the point that he wouldn't, you know, that he, everyone was sort of, no one was supposed to talk to him. Mm-hmm. And he managed to cover the city of North Adams for months at a time that way.
And how hard is it to get an actual story when the person at the top, the most powerful person in a particular office, the mayor here, the president somewhere else, the governor somewhere else, has locked you out of that information? You have to find another way to get the story, I assume.
Here's some free crisis management media advice from a journalist. You can choose to be in a story and have the, you know, take your space, be a presence, articulate your opinion, defend it in the, you know, the marketplace of ideas, or whatever that horrible phrase is. You can be like an active member of the story that's being told, or you're not in it.
Or you can be the story, exactly. Right? If you're trying to block access.
Almost every time.
That's the other
time,
thing I know a lot of television reporters would always say is like, if someone is going to stop you from getting the story, that is now the story.
Yeah, it's the Streisand effect. The more you say, don't look at this, people are going to look at it more and more. So if you choose to not participate, that's fine. I'll go to the person who will talk, and that'll be a very different story now. Yeah. So,
I mean, we're going to dig. We're going to, you know, try to find people who are going to talk to us on deep background, or, you know, find sources. We're going to start lobbing FOIA requests at you, you know, public records requests. And, you know, that. And also, just as a crisis management, you know, the idea is that if you get out, some people just, it's a not very well understood precept that you're supposed to get out in front of a story and define the story before it's defined for you.
Yeah, I think there's
lots of folks have sort of their first instinct is, you know, to put up the wall instead of say, okay, well, you know, instead of to get out there and try to define it first. I mean, I have a friend in Connecticut who was in crisis communications, and we talked about this on a quasi-regular basis. And, you know, and instead of, the cover-up becomes the story because the cover-up is always worse.
Well, that goes right back
always.
To Watergate, right?
Yeah.
That was really the first time that the country experienced en masse what happens when you've got a massive... It's not the first time it ever happened, obviously, but it was really the first time that I think a lot of people woke up to the idea that, no, the cover-up is the problem. And that is that's really what knocked Richard Nixon out of the presidency was the cover-up for Watergate, not actually what happened. What happened during Watergate was pretty bad also, but I don't know that he would have been, you know, had to resign the presidency because of that. These days, that seems kind of tame, actually, considering what happens on a day-to-day basis. And I just want to pivot a little bit to the idea that we kind of talked about whether you can or can't get the story from your primary source. The AP and other wire sources right now nationally have been taken out of the White House press briefing room, have been taken out of Air Force One when the president is going on a foreign trip. And so how is it that we, the public, can get those stories now in a more direct, you know, there's nothing considered completely unbiased, but in a more direct reportage than filtered through another press organization with a very particular political bias? How do we know that those stories are actually true, accurate, or just more spin?
Well, that's a fascinating question, Sean. And part of the beauty of what it means to be like a local community-based journalist is that, like, part of the success of the Trump political project is to shatter like truth and objectivity to a point where like it's complicated to understand how significant it is. Everyone is in such a reality tunnel now that they can construct like this is like the form of late capitalism, right? Like you can assemble a worldview out of like these shattered fragments of different people's, you know, anything that appeals to, you know, I think all of us like to tell ourselves a story about who we are and what we're doing. And in most of our lives, we want to feel exciting and dynamic and heroic. And we seek out these narratives that make us feel that way, that affirm our belief that we are in fact correct and that the worldview we have is exciting and interesting in the future. There's an old story, and you know, I don't know how often Wilhelm Reich gets brought up on WTBR, but he wrote The Mass Psychology of Fascism. It's an amazing book. He was in Weimar, Germany, and he was like, I was a Marxist, and I was watching the Nazis. At the Marxist meetings, we had graphs. At their meetings, they called people the children of God. Like, who do you think won that argument? So, I mean, in a lot of ways, the fascism handbook is like a really old one where this idea that, like, you know, the New York Times for a while during the first Trump administration, you might recall this, they were noting every lie Donald Trump told. And after 4 years, they had a huge list. And then he won re-election 4 years later. So, you know, there's the idea that our national news world is so infected with corporate allegiances. It's so deliberately neutered. You know, you can switch to MSNBC or Fox and get whatever flavor you want. I'm not really sure.
And yet there's this narrative that the mainstream media itself is biased and that we're not getting the full story just by listening to our traditional news outlets, that you really need to go to the fringe to get the real story, right? That we hear that a lot.
But, I mean, the people it's saying crazy, that are part of the mainstream media, well, which is, you know, I mean, having worked for the Associated Press, I have a slightly, you know, personal stake in this. But
sure.
I think in a better world, media organizations would have stood up and said, no, you can't leave the Associated. Then leave me out too, because because I'm not gonna take this gift from you if we're treating objective journalism that way, mm-hmm. and the Associated Press being deliberately nonpartisan, mm-hmm. and that was a function more of business than of ideology. Mm-hmm. That was because mm-hmm. papers in New York City needed to be able to have the same source for foreign news, mm-hmm. and. In order to stop from clubbing each other on their way out to row out to the telegraph ships to get the latest, so they decided, okay, we're going to have a co-op and it's going to be strictly nonpartisan, so none of us can complain. Mm-hmm. To leave that out purposely and for everyone else to be like, okay, sure, that's more for me. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a bit of a sad commentary, and I wish our industry would be a little better about it.
We're speaking with Greg Sokenick and Josh Landes here this morning on Morning Drive. We reached that top of the hour time that we always take our quick little break, thank our underwriters, and do our station ID. I know it's hard to rip yourself away from this conversation. It is really gripping to me. I hope all the listeners are finding this interesting as well. It's tremendous, and I hope we can get as many more things in the second half of the show as we did in the first, but let's do that quick break. Break now, and we'll be right back with Morning Drive right after this. Stay tuned.
If you listed lies now,
Morning Drive here on WTBR FM.
This is Pittsfield Community Radio, 89.7 WTBR FM Pittsfield, 88.1 WSBR Lee.
Support for WTBR comes from Berkshire Community College. Free community college for any Massachusetts resident without a bachelor's degree at BCC. Find out more at berkshirecc.edu. And from Sundrini Awnings and Home Improvement, providing awnings and canopies in Western Mass. Retractable awnings, retractable screens, gutter and gutter protection systems, commercial awnings and screen rooms, customized solutions available. Online at sundrini.com.
Have you ever dreamed of being a radio DJ, spinning your favorite vinyl, CDs, and MP3s? Have you ever wanted to share conversations with interesting guests with the community? Then the WTBR FM Programming Committee wants to hear from you. We are now accepting proposals for new programs. For more information, visit WTBRFM.com or call 445-4234. Pittsfield Community Radio, for the love of radio.
What would it be like not having PCTV's reliable coverage of our Pittsfield City meetings? Well, the answer is it would be like driving in the darkness without headlights. We need the light to show us exactly what's coming our way. PCTV's coverage is that light. It's so reliable and dependable, we don't even think about not having it, but nothing can be taken for granted. Support this building block of democracy today. It's too important to lose, especially now. Pittsfield Community Television, see it all, decide for yourself.
Hi, it's Jen Glockner. I'm the director of the Office of Cultural Development for the wonderful city of Pittsfield, and I also host the Cultural Pittsfield radio show on WTBR. It airs every Friday at 8:30 in the morning. Stay tuned to learn all about the arts and culture scene for the city of Pittsfield and beyond. We hope you listen in every Friday at 8:30 on 89.7 FM WTBR.
Support for WTBR comes from Greylock Federal Credit Union, proud to support high school arts and sports programs to help our community thrive. Greylock Federal, with locations throughout the Berkshires and online at greylock.org. And from UCP of Western Massachusetts. UCP of Western Mass is hiring full and part-time opportunities to provide a life without limits for people with disabilities. For more information, ucpwma.org/jobs.
You have chosen wisely.
WTBR. And now back to the Morning Drive on WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio.
All right, welcome back to Morning Drive on 89.7 WTBR FM, also 88.1 WSBR in Lee, and thanks for joining us this morning, Friday, May 23rd, and glad you're aboard. We are speaking with Greg Sokenick, the news editor and reporter at Berkshire Eagle, Josh Landes, Berkshire Bureau Chief for WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Great to have both of these guys on this morning talking about the state of journalism and their jobs and all kinds of good stuff. A fascinating conversation. First, let's go to the weather forecast, see what we've got in store for us today, and then back to the conversation.
Yorkshire weather.
WTBR radar weather for the Pittsfield area. Today, mostly cloudy. Patchy drizzle this morning, then showers likely this afternoon. Highs in the lower 50s. West wind around 5 miles per hour. Chance of rain 70%. Tonight, showers likely. Lows in the mid 40s. West wind 5 to 10 miles per hour. Chance of rain 60%. Saturday, mostly cloudy with a 50% chance of showers. Highs in the mid 50s. West wind 5 to 10 miles per hour with gusts up to 20 miles per hour. Weather forecasts for WTBR-FM are provided by the National Weather Service.
All right, there you go. Wet again, maybe nicer for Memorial Day. We'll see about that. The weather forecast here for WTBR doesn't quite go out that far, but we'll get there at some point. And maybe we'll get to summer at some point. You know what will happen? It'll just go from, you know, this fall, spring, winter kind of stuff to like 90 degrees. That's what happens every single year. I don't know why. But all right, welcome back, Greg Sokenik. Did I get that right? News editor?
Yeah, news editor and reporter.
And reporter, thank you.
So, yeah, it's... Nah, never mind. It's complicated.
And Josh Landy's from WAMC, Berkshire Bureau Chief, and obviously reporter as well.
Yes, you nailed it. Thank you.
All right. So great conversations we've been having here. Let's go into a couple of specific stories locally that have been right on the front page. Challenges, I'm sure, for both of you when a big story like that hits. I guess we'll start with the Great Barrington annual town meeting recently, and it shouldn't have been a big story, right? It's just an ordinary town meeting.
Well, just to clarify, technically speaking, this was at a special town meeting before the town meeting.
Okay. This is held down at Monument Mountain Regional High School, and they've got the auditorium down there. That's where they have their meetings. And you got a surprise when you tried to walk in the door to report on the meeting.
So this had actually happened once before last year, and at the time it sort of added a little note in my head, and I was like, well, that's odd. But basically, I had shown up at this public meeting, and I had been told as a non-resident I had to have the explicit permission of the moderator to enter the meeting.
To enter, not to speak at the meeting, but just to come into the premises.
Right, which last year struck me as odd, simply because, when I do, this town meeting season, which is my favorite time of year, I did, six or seven town meetings. I got more to come. This was a really odd thing. I nowhere else in Berkshire County, like last night in Williamstown, as non-resident, they're like, all right, well, head on in.
Yeah.
You don't have a clicker. Who cares?
No.
But in Great Barrington, which is, often it's its own tempest in a teapot, there was this sort of odd rule that emerged last year, and I sort of wrote it off in my head. But then this year, it really stuck me as quite odd and inappropriate, because for very obvious reasons, there's a lot of complicated rules in Massachusetts, but when it comes to open meeting laws and town meeting laws, it's not complicated. And in fact, on Great Barrington's website, if you click the link to Secretary of State Bill Galvin's Guide to Town Meeting, it's a one-sentence thing. Any member of the public may attend town meeting. Not complicated.
Yeah.
It's one sentence, and I know Greg knows this. If you look at MGL, Massachusetts General Law, to have a one sentence relatively, it's 12 syllables in that sentence. That's the shortest sentence in Massachusetts law anywhere.
Yeah, this isn't rocket science.
Right.
And so were you denied access to that meeting? Were you able to report on that meeting?
I was able to report on both of the meetings, but a couple things irritated me. The first thing was that another member of the press said, oh, that's funny, they just waved me in. So that added a little, I was like, all right, well, I don't like that.
Yeah.
And then what really pushed me over the edge was that, well, one, this was a very funny meeting, because it's a classic Great Barrington special town meeting. They're having it out about something. It's Great Barrington. They live for this. But at the same time, I'm running around in the margins having a series of heated conversations with town officials.
Well, so because now the story is suddenly different for you, right?
Right, because I looked it up and I was like, I knew I was right to begin with. And I was like, what are you citing? What are you pointing to? You can stop doing this right now. So I leave the meeting at some point to go get a drink of water, use the bathroom, whatever. Another non-resident shows up and they tell him, you can only enter this meeting if you ask permission from the guy who's leading the meeting.
Which
and it's like, okay, so you fully barred this guy from entering a public meeting for no reason. And the simple fact that, and I understand that these are not malicious, evil people, but the way that things happen in these small worlds is that some misinterpretation gets passed off as this weird local law, and you have people saying this is the law when it's not the law, and it drives me crazy when I know I'm right and people are telling me that I'm wrong. So by the end of the meeting, this was a little cinematic. I'm up on stage talking to the town clerk and the town solicitor. They have a little huddle, and the solicitor goes, so legally, you are correct. And I was like, I know I'm right. This is super not complicated, you know? So it was a real...
What else is there to say after legally you are correct? I don't know.
It was an unforced error on Great Barrington's part. What made me more frustrated was how much they pushed back against it when it was so ludicrous. And we wouldn't have filed a complaint if they had not made it unbelievably difficult the entire time to point out that they were making up an arbitrary restriction and applying it randomly in a way that it's like straight up not democratic. It's not Massachusetts. It's not how we act. And no other community was doing this. So no one made Great Barrington do that. That was 100% of their own volition. It was a very silly situation.
And yet you got to report on it anyway, and the public got the story, which I guess is the ultimate goal, right? That's what you want to, that's what you're there for.
Yeah. I mean, look, I mean, can, will the WAMC Berkshire Bureau chief, you know, solve America's democratic crisis? Hey, maybe. Mm. But for now, I know that for sure I can like try to get at least one municipality to reverse a completely unnecessary, nonsensical thing that is simply wrong. Mm-hmm. So, you know.
And what did it get them? More media coverage because we wrote about it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Right. You know, you've created a dust up that like no one made you do. Like, why are you doing this? So, you know, it was nice to have the eagle at my back on that one, because it was a good time where we fell as a, you know, a press corps into some very clear, like, this is inappropriate. Yeah. And we addressed it.
And that kind of ties into what Greg just said a little while ago about sort of press organizations supporting each other when one is under fire for whatever reason. Maybe it's the AP and the White House press briefing room and other organizations need to say, no, we're not going to just fall in line. Maybe it's, you know, going after CBS 60 Minutes or ABC, Disney for interviews and things like that. You know, where other media organizations, how they react to that is going to be critical in a lot of ways, right? Because at that moment, you say, well, I could either save ourselves and our own organization and live to fight another day, or I could jump in the fray and, because this could be me, right?
Yeah, I think people sort of lost sight of that. Like, you know, if they decide to bar this organization today, you know, what's stopping them from having it be you tomorrow?
Mm-hmm.
Well, did I just use the phrase due process without using the phrase due process? I think I did.
Due process.
There you go again.
Someone has to say it.
Well, it's nice because, like, you know, Greg and I are not ludicrously wealthy from working in local public media and the local paper.
And I suspect many reporters and editors
on sale.
Are not.
Right. So, like, you know, it stinks to live in a country where the market share repercussions of a bottom line profit, like, that's going to impact a private mega corporation news network and their decision making around how to react to outright fascism, versus you kind of can't, like, you could rob my house. There's a lot of UCDs. I mean, I don't know. Like, I don't make a lot of money. I love my job. I love being a part of the Berkshires. I think it's an incredible privilege to do this. I have a quality of life that I think is unbelievable. I'm so lucky. And the fact that, you know, those interests mean nothing. I mean, yeah, like, you know, Disney, ABC, CBS, Fox, you know, they are a profit-making company. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are people, today actually is my birthday. I'm 35 today. I don't remember Walter Cronkite or whatever. I don't have this implicit trust in CBS or whatever.
Edward, like, R. Murrow.
Right, sure. Like, mm-hmm. That's an era that I have to watch movies about now. So I don't trust any of these
outlets. As long as they're still available.
As long as they're still, well, that's another thing. God, don't get me started. But I'm just, you know, it's this kind of thing where, you know, the Berkshire Eagle and WAMC are not profit-driven undertakings. Hmm. We're genuinely people who love the part of the world that we serve. And I can sleep a little easier knowing that it's people like me and Greg doing this and not people who are, you know, receiving lavish compensation to say exactly what their corporate overlords want them to say.
Greg, why don't you talk a little bit about the challenges of getting the biggest story right now in Pittsfield, and has been for the last 5-6 months. The report at PHS, which obviously there's a headline in the Berkshire Eagle this morning about the cost of that investigation. But while the school committee was debating whether they were going to release the full report, or whether it was going to be a redacted report, or whether it was going to be a summary report of some kind. And I want you to talk about both your challenges of getting the real information in the story, but then also the balance that the press has, the responsibility of, you know, privacy versus the public's right to know.
Okay, and how much time do we have?
I was going to say, we could do a whole hour on that, but see what you can do with it.
Okay, where to start on that? I guess I'll start at the, sort of talking about public right to know, maybe I'll just start with the situation at a school committee meeting where was going to be a point of order about whether the executive session that was called, that was, you know, cited in the warrant, you know, in the meeting agenda, mm-hmm. as it should have been, was a legitimate use of executive session.
Okay.
But there's only so many reasons, you know, under state law where you can go into executive session.
Right.
And I had a question about, well, okay, there was going to be a discussion about, you know, what the school committee was going to do about the situation with public records and with Sierra Battery's request for the full report and their response that we're not going to give you that because this exemption, that exemption. So, I mean, I didn't exactly relish the idea of getting up in front of a meeting and saying, hey, guys, I got a problem with this. You know, because I'd rather, you know, my job is to report the story, not to be the story. But every once in a while, you know, as representatives of the public, we are drawn into that role. And so.
And it's a legitimate question.
Yeah, it was a legitimate question.
Can this be discussed in open session or does it have the right to go into executive session?
And it turned out, you know, that, you know, Mayor Marchetti was not comfortable with bringing that into executive session. And so that got talked about, you know, in public in front of God and everybody. And but that speaks to transparency and the idea that the public, you know, that it's our role to hold government accountable and to protect and serve the public's right to know. I mean, that, and so we sort of talk about this being a for-profit industry, but we also talk about the importance of what we do to democracy. To making sure that people, that we have an informed electorate. I mean, sort of here, I didn't expect to be quoting de Tocqueville this morning, but here we are.
And do you think, though, that there are boundaries that we still have to pay attention to
absolutely.
When it comes to privacy and things like that? Like,
this story has been nothing if not a challenge about
rape
that.
Rape victims, for example, naming them in a paper or on the air. You know, that seems to be a boundary. Are there other boundaries that we sort of pay attention to and that journalists say, no, we won't go there? We'll still get the story. The story will be sufficient without those details.
Man, that is such a case-by-case basis situation because, I mean, and especially in a world where anyone basically can be a journalist and anyone can publish. I mean, back in the gatekeeping world where, you know, where we're the only sort of game in town and, you know, so we've got a decision to make whether people are going to see this or not. Well, people have the same right that we do in order to obtain information. If something happens in open court, you know, that is not privilege. That is information that anybody can get their hands on, you know, and that would include, you know, who the witnesses were in, you know, in a rape trial, for example, the example you cited. So that becomes, there's a real tension there. And I think that's sort of something that we have to stop and think about every time it comes up. There's not really a blanket policy that I think you can apply to it.
Yeah.
I mean, that sort of brings us to the, you know, sort of current state of affairs where you have, you know, witnesses who came forward, you know, in the Bulky Richardson and Jelinas report who were not expecting that they were going to be named or not expecting they were going to be identified.
Yep.
And so, I mean, so the school committee, you know, has that in mind when they're when they're talking about, you know, we can't even issue this, even redacted.
Yeah. And my first thought, too, was future investigations where people think about participating and telling the truth about what happened, but they might have that little thing in the back of their head said, but this is going to be public, so I better not say anything. And that kind of wrecks the whole process.
Yeah, but no one ever said this was going to be easy. And it is not easy to speak truth to power. I mean, there's a reason that people don't do it as often as we do. I mean, the reason that we're paid to do it, because it's not something that everybody, you know, wants to do. It's, you know, it takes some conviction and some you know, some reps to be able to sort of work yourself up to do it.
Well, and we're also seeing like this very the cycle that's happening in America right now, where it's like, we have a social media environment where people are rightfully concerned about their name being floated in relation to anything spicy because it is shocking how quickly that bloodbath just emerges. It's shocking.
Yeah.
Even if there's like a lot of really valid concern or suspicion or fear, you know, and we're talking about this just like local drama in Pittsfield, you know, look back at the history of Facebook, you know, there are like, you know, political revolutions, genocides, like this tool is really horrifying. So right now we have like an outright fascist in the White House who is hanging out with the guys who are generating this culture where if your name enters a certain sphere, you've like basically lost all right to privacy. So it's not complicated what's going on here in my mind. Like the corporate interests and the interests of like a Trump-like figure in America, it is a really complicated time to try to enter any public conversation. And then that atrophies democracy because people can't have a normal conversation. Yeah. And we're a country where we're so used to being lied to and so used to being manipulated that I think everyone's responses are so, like, you know, unbelievably harsh and cruel and brutal across the political spectrum at this point. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of ways, you look at, like, the long talk about media, but, like, the role of, like, a Rush Limbaugh or people who, you know, turn the temperature of these culture wars up to this, like, horrifying boiling point. And the fact that the people who control the settings and all of that are now, like, hand in hand, you know, the number of people who get their news from Facebook or I'm not, or Twitter or whatever, like, it's a huge, it's a shockingly yeah. large percentage.
Well, and that kind of brings up another talk. We talked about media consolidation briefly, and that has led to some of what we have. And Greg mentioned the gatekeeping time where there were only a few news outlets and you basically, you know, believed whatever you read in the paper or whatever you saw on TV. That was the case at one point. And now with media consolidation, you have fewer and fewer sources of news and fewer outlets to listen to. But then you also have this digital revolution, social media, where now everybody's a publisher, right? You don't know if the story is accurate. You don't know if anyone's gone to any lengths to verify whether the facts that they're putting on their Facebook page or whatever are true, but they're out there. And like you said, Josh, it's quick. It's lightning fast. And so do people have more power now through their digital and social media outlets than the mainstream, the traditional media has?
That's a really great question. You know, I think about the fact that...
Or is the power balance shifting, I guess, maybe would be a better question.
I would say, like, in almost every way, it is advantageous to institutions to have the masses as roiled up as possible and turning each other as much as possible. Hmm. And again, to go back to my, like, leftist ranting here, part of, like, late capitalism is this idea that, like, you know, the perfect vision of, like, the American right is, like, a paranoid, isolated person where everything is a threat and everything is about maintaining this defensive posture at all times. And, like, weaponizing that paranoia, like, the things that I try to express in my work is, like, you know, I want there to be compassion and a community consensus and the idea that we're looking at for most vulnerable and we rise and fall together. And, like, that's so important. But in the social media landscape where, like, you can, again, construct an entire reality tunnel around exactly where you're sitting and reify all of that isolation and paranoia, it's really hard to break through that. Like, if you see a journalist like me and Greg and say, I don't trust that guy because I think you have ulterior motives, unfortunately, there's a perfectly reasonable, like, reaction to the world we live in. Like, that's not a crazy reaction.
But okay, they see you and they say you have ulterior motives. And what is your option? Is to listen to only the echo chamber that you believe in? I guess that's the next question. And then I want to kind of wrap in this new revolution of AI, which we've talked about in the show sometimes. And there was an incident recently where Elon Musk's AI Grok was asked about white genocide in South Africa. And the first response seemed to be kind of an honest response, which was, it's not supported by the facts, right? And then the next day, something in this AI got tweaked, and suddenly every response that was coming out had something to, even if you weren't asking about white genocide in South Africa, was telling you about white genocide in South Africa. So, you know, is that where is the cautionary tale there with the next revolution of technology for journalists?
When you have one paranoid racist loser like Elon Musk who insists he wants, this is exactly
tell
what I'm
how
talking
you really
about.
Feel.
Okay.
Yeah, don't sugarcoat it, Josh.
He has his finger on the button and he can change reality to fit. It's never fails to amaze me whenever, like, a white guy is like, I'm the most put upon guy in the room by far. Mm. And it's like, that's crazy. You're not.
Has America ever experienced that level of power with one person being able to influence that amount of information for the world?
Well, it's a fascinating question.
And I'm thinking,
like, JP Morgan bought America twice.
John Rockefeller.
Yeah. Like, those guys, like, owned entire...
What,
like,
about the newspapers at the turn of the 20th century?
Oh, God. I mean, the thing... I just want to say, Greg, I'll give you some space here because I'm getting excited about this. I love American history. There's often this doomerism that right now is the worst moment in American history. Guys, we have had a ton of worst moments in American history. And the times, like, that we need to be most, like, conscious of are the fact that there is a very clear trail in history that takes us here. There was a time where robber barons literally bought and sold entire industries and bailed out America and appointed cabinet members. Like, that's what these people want to go back to. This is not somewhere we haven't been before.
Right.
This is a very well-trod path where, you know, industrialists and corporate interests have just bought and sold America fairly transparently for centuries. Yeah. So
we've seen it before. This seems to be a bit amplified.
But have we learned anything?
No.
I don't think so.
No one wants to learn anything. They want their story to be reified.
Yeah.
Wow.
I guess that's the big question. Have we learned, will we learn anything, or are we just destined relive everything that Josh just talked about?
Well, my favorite recent AI story is the one out of the Chicago Sun-Times printing an entire section of printing a list of book reviews, a third of which were books that do not exist because they were generated by a large language model.
So that's a hallucination.
Hallucination. Yeah. And that not only like hit the internet, that was printed in the Chicago Sun-Times, and it took maybe about 48 hours for people to actually figure out, oh, wait a minute, he didn't write that. didn't write that either. She didn't write that.
And so that can be devastating to the trust of the media as well, right? But are there AI tools that can assist journalists?
No.
The answer is no.
I like to say no. I like to say I'm sort of in that boat. I mean,
because certainly there's transcriptions and things like that.
There's transcription. Right? Certainly Otter has bailed me out on a couple of occasions. I mean, I think certainly there's opportunity for data analysis. I haven't used them yet. I've sort of been the grumpy old man who says, oh, I'm going to do this myself, because why would I deny myself the opportunity to learn a new skill? Except for the fact that every time I try to use Excel, I have to relearn it all over again. That or call my kid and ask them to help me. Where were we going?
Well,
the AI. My writing will always be my own work.
Mm-hmm.
They'll carry me out. That's not true.
It's so easy to identify AI writing when you're looking at Facebook posts, too. Do you find that to be true? I mean, it's like, oh, God, this is another
LinkedIn
AI.
LinkedIn is a land of ChatGPT writing.
Yeah.
Well, first off, the ecological impact of ChatGPT, I would not sleep well if I didn't say this. It is ecologically impossibly immoral to use ChatGPT. I can't stress this enough. It is, you think your car sucks? Like, ChatGPT is an unbelievable waste of resources in this burning, dwindling world that we've shattered as humans. But more to the point, you know, this is yet another thing that's being pitched as like the great equalizer. You don't have to have this college degree to learn this code that elites speak. But at the same time, you're just, you know, instead of learning anything about that or how to like subvert that or undercut it or cut through it, you're just learning how to sort of get a computer to babble in that sort of tone.
You're not
getting anything out of it.
Mm-hmm. And if it's an echo chamber, that's even more dangerous.
Could be from that example that I mentioned.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's like saying that, you know, that you, because you popped a Lean Cuisine in a microwave, that you know how to make chicken marsala.
I don't?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
I mean, it's actually kind of hard. I mean, you have to, you know, sort of reduce the pan and emulsify with butter. It's not a health food. Hmm. I mean, but it's, my concern is that, you know, sort of, does efficiency equal, you know, quality?
Well, you know,
and here's a business where,
or is,
you know,
it just good enough? I think maybe that's where we're at too, right?
Yeah. You know, but here's a business that, you know, because of its economic model and the number of times it shot itself in the foot, does it have any toes left? that, you know, there's a strong argument to be made for, you know, we're going to survive as a business when we have fewer people. And I mean, this technology seems, you know, almost, you know, this technology seems custom made for a large company that, you know, for a venture capital firm that wanted to run a lot of newspapers with very few people.
Yeah, because the corporate interests that govern the country want more money and slash, I don't know. ChatGPT drives me absolutely crazy because, again, it's like when that AI thing came out where like it made like a profile, like a picture of you for your social media avatar, and everyone came out looking a little slimmer and a little more symmetrical and a little more, and everyone's like, oh, I like this.
Is that all I had to do?
Oh, that's so interesting. I like yeah, so like, this is what we've created.
And just think, this is only the beginning of this technology.
It's,
right?
It's the digital Narcissus staring at his reflection in the pool, but instead it's like, what if you could see the exact reflection you wanted? And hey, I will say this. I know we're getting to the end of the hour.
Yes, we are.
If you have not rewatched the late, great David Lynch's Lost Highway, that is a movie from the 90s that's all about what it means to actually confront our own digital record of who we are and what we've been and shatter through these lies we tell ourselves. What an amazing
movie. Can't go wrong recommending a David Lynch movie.
Did not have that on my bingo card, but that's a good recommendation.
Go. Awesome. You know, I had so much more on this sheet that I wanted to ask you. The threat to public media, especially actually. Give us a quick hit on that, Josh Landes, and we got to go.
It's not complicated. You know, any institution that wants to shield itself from criticism will cut off any avenue of access to itself to try to protect itself and keep you at arm's length. The Trump administration would love nothing more than to have, you know, if you watch these press conferences, there are the people there who go, is your plan too brilliant? Like, that's, you know, that's what they want. Like, you know, and they don't want anyone, you know, shattering that to even when it's transparently ridiculous. So that's where we are.
Public media will survive. That's my prediction.
Our audience has come through in an amazing way. WMC listeners, also known as WTBR, also vital. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, our local newspapers must survive as well. Greg Sokenick, news editor and reporter for the Berkshire Eagle. Josh Landes, Berkshire Bureau Chief for WAMC Northeast Public Radio. I want to thank both of you for being here today. I'm sorry to have to play you out because that's the music. I should have picked something better than the theme music. But, you know, we did the Doobie Brothers at the top. So
heck yeah. Thank you,
Sean. Thank you very much.
Greg, it's been great.
I hope this again. This has been great.
And I love that.
Look forward to the conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Have a great weekend. Stay away from the raindrops and enjoy your Memorial Day. And best to everyone who has someone in their family that served. And we salute them. Thank you.